Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marcy Wheeler, an investigative journalist with Exposed Facts, who discusses what's at stake in the trial of former CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling for journalism and the public's right to know. Richard Heinberg of the Post-Carbon Institute, who examines the reasons why the world has witnessed a dramatic drop in oil prices in recent months. And Elisa Simmons of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who talks about the campaign to defeat the proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement and fast-track authority. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Long before the recent terrorist attacks in France, a growing wave of anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant protests surged in eastern Germany. The continuing protests are centered in Dresden, an area in Germany where few residents are foreign-born. Germany's political establishment, including Chancellor Angela Merkel, condemned the anti-immigrant group, the Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamization of the West, or Pegida, as motivated by prejudice, coldness, and even hatred in their hearts. Since the 1970s, Germany has extended an open door to immigrants, first guest workers from Turkey and Italy, and more recently from Eastern Europe. Cologne's iconic cathedral turned its lights off on January 5th in a symbolic protest against the anti-Muslim movement. Cathedral Provost Norbert Feldof called his nation's anti-immigrant movement Nazist, racist, and extremist. Cem Özdemir, co-chair of the German Green Party and son of Turkish immigrants, asserted, "The line is not between Christians and Muslims. The line is between those who are intolerant and the others, the majority." The appeal of right-wing nationalist parties across Europe is expected to grow in response to the massacre of journalists and others at the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo and a kosher market in Paris. Pakistan has established new military courts to try terrorism suspects in response to the December 16th massacre of nearly 150 children by Taliban terrorists at a military-run school in Lahore. The new courts are part of a political offensive by Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif that includes revoking a moratorium on the death penalty and creating a new counterterrorism force. The new military court will override civilian courts, which could lead to a backlash from Pakistan's strong independent judiciary. In 2007, lawyers led a powerful protest movement against former President and General Pervez Musharraf, who had fired several Supreme Court judges. Pakistan's mainstream political parties endorsed the new anti-terrorism courts, while legislators loyal to opposition leader Imran Khan abstained, as did members of several religious parties. Over the last decade, more than 55,000 Pakistani citizens have died in terrorist-related incidents. While the new United States Republican-controlled Congress is aggressively pushing for the construction of the Keystone XL oil pipeline, Canadian energy giant Enbridge is promoting twin pipelines that could transport as many as 4 million barrels of oil a day across rural Minnesota to Superior, Wisconsin. Enbridge's massive expansion in the Great Lakes region would bring new supplies of shale and tar sands oil in direct conflict with the treaty rights of the Anishinaabe Native people, who have the legal right to preserve their traditional livelihoods. Enbridge currently runs a network of 50,000 miles of pipelines, moving oil from Alberta tar sands mines to refineries in the U.S. and Ontario. Now, Enbridge wants to build the new $2.5 billion Sandpiper pipeline project to transport light sweet crude from the shale oil fields in North Dakota to Lake Superior. As proposed, the pipeline would cross over 130 public lands, including the Mississippi Headwaters State Forest and the watershed of Lower Rice Lake, the largest wild rice crop on the Anishinaabe White Earth Reservation. The news magazine In These Times reports environmentalists and Native peoples fear a massive oil spill from the new shale oil pipeline, given that Enbridge was responsible for the largest inland oil spill in U.S. history along Michigan's Kalamazoo River in 2010. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
In the aftermath of a series of brutal terrorist attacks that claimed the lives of 17, including 8 journalists at the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, police officers and hostages at a kosher food market, more than 3 million people marched in Paris in solidarity with the victims and in support of freedom of the press. 40 heads of state also joined the march, but as many critics pointed out, some of the nations they represented, such as Turkey, Egypt, Jordan, Russia, and Israel, have poor records when it comes to press freedom at home. The U.S., criticized by some for not sending a high-level representative to participate in the Paris march, also has a flawed record on freedom of the press. During 6 years of the Obama administration, the number of whistleblower investigations under the 1917 Espionage Act is more than double of those conducted in all previous presidential administrations combined. For more than 6 years, New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author James Risen has been the target of federal prosecutors for his refusal to disclose his sources. The Department of Justice had ordered Risen to testify against one of his alleged sources, former CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling, who is believed to have provided the journalist with confidential information regarding a failed CIA operation to sabotage Iran's nuclear weapons program, which was published in his 2006 book, State of War. Risen has long refused to cooperate with prosecutors and identify his source, risking imprisonment. However, the day before Jeffrey Sterling's trial began on January 13th, the Justice Department said it would not call Risen to testify, effectively taking the threat of prison off the table. Your reporter spoke with Marcy Wheeler, an investigative journalist with Exposed Facts, who discusses what's at stake in the trial of former CIA officer Sterling and the larger issue of the government's prosecution of whistleblowers, as well as the consequences for journalism and the public's right to know.
Risen came out with a book, State of War, now 9 years ago. And the book had a chapter on the warrantless wiretap program, which he had just broken with Eric Litblau in the New York Times. And there was also a chapter on what's called Operation Merlin, which was an effort to deal dubious blueprints to Iran, nuclear blueprints, as part of an effort to sabotage their nuclear program. And Sterling is alleged to be Risen's source for that story, although Risen's a good enough journalist, I can't believe he only had one source for it. So they're going after Sterling as his source, even though it's unlikely he's the only guy. And some people, myself included, can't help but notice that the government also went hard after Risen's sources for the warrantless wiretap program story that he did. And although they tried really hard to prosecute Thomas Drake, who was a former NSA executive, who went to the inspector general to report waste, fraud, and abuse, and the government charged him, among other things, for documents that the inspector general had told him to keep. So I think the government went after both of Risen's set of sources, and Sterling was the one ultimately who got charged because they could kind of, or they thought they could kind of isolate him. Whereas in the warrantless wiretap story, those sources would quickly lead to the fact that it was an illegal program. Here, they're just going after Sterling, who before he got fired from the CIA in 2002, he had complained about being treated improperly as an African-American. He wasn't getting the same opportunities that white case agents were, and therefore he couldn't really advance because he couldn't spy effectively. And so they fired him, and then they went after him for leaking this story to Risen. And one of the arguments that he's been making is that they're selectively prosecuting him among a great number of people who leaked because he raised a stink about the employment.
Marcy, as you begin your coverage of this trial of former CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling, what is important for Americans to know about this trial? Why is it important for us to track and to understand?
Well, it's important because Sterling was one of a number of people who were trying to go to the press with stupid stuff that our counterproliferation people were doing at CIA and other WMD people. And whether it's Sterling or not, it was an important story in 2003 when Risen first tried to report it because we had just been lied into war on dubious claims about WMD. So this story was one of a number of pieces of stories of the CIA doing crazy things with WMD work. That's one. It's important for us to know that. And if Sterling is Rising Source or whoever else is Rising Source, it's important for that person or those people to have come forward and let us know about it. Another reason it's important is because the government really does seem to have gone after Rising in the guise of going after Sterling here. They got some of his phone records. They got his bank records. They got his travel records. So they were treating Rising effectively as a suspect. After having gone basically to the Supreme Court to fight for their right to call Rising to testify, today they said, well, we're not going to call him to testify, but we don't think the defense should be able to either. The judge was like, look, you know, you guys fought for the right to be able to call this guy to testimony. You can't now say that the defense can't do it. And the other reason it's really important is because, you know, there are really powerful people in the government who leak classified information all the time. There was a report on Friday from the New York Times that some people within DOJ think David Petraeus, the former top general and CIA director, shared top secret information with his mistress, and that he should be charged under the same law that Kiriakou and Sterling and others have been charged under, and yet he probably won't be. And so you've got this inequity in law where the powerful people can leak and use it to make themselves look good, which is exactly what Petraeus was doing here. He was getting a very favorable biography written by his mistress. But people who are trying to alert American citizens to important things they should know are the ones who are facing prison time. And that's not a sustainable situation for democracy.
Marcy Wheeler, what are the groups that are supporting both James Rising and Jeffrey Sterling as he now faces trial?
You know, on Rising, most journalism organizations have come out to support him, to say that he should not have to testify about his sources. Sterling has gotten a lot less support, partly because it's hard to tell whether somebody's a quote-unquote legitimate whistleblower. But that, you know, there's a group, Roots Action, that is supporting him, that has a petition with tens of thousands of signatures to call on DOJ not to prosecute him. And it's supported by, you know, solid progressive organizations saying you need to rely on whistleblowers to find out the truth. But I think that there are fewer people supporting Sterling, which is a little bit troubling because you need both sides to liberate information, if you will.
That was Marcy Wheeler, an investigative journalist with Exposed Facts. Learn more about the campaign to end the government prosecution of whistleblowers and journalists by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Plummeting oil prices are grabbing headlines all over the world. The prices dropped in the past few months from over $100 a barrel to less than $50. That's had repercussions throughout the energy sector and has also led, among other things, to more Americans buying gas-guzzling vehicles. Gasoline prices in the U.S. are heading as low as $2 a gallon in some places, down from $4 a gallon. The drop in oil prices is mostly due to more supply and less demand. But at least one analyst, independent petroleum geologist Art Berman, says the drop was exacerbated by the fact that quantitative easing ended in July 2014, exactly when prices began to fall. Because world oil prices are tied to the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. government was no longer printing massive amounts of money, the dollar grew stronger and the price of oil went down. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Richard Heinberg, senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, who notes that before the recent drop, oil prices were exceptionally high. Here he explains how the drop in oil prices is impacting other energy sectors, with a focus on natural gas and liquefied natural gas produced for export.
It's mostly supply and demand, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that oil prices have been very high for the last several years, and that has destroyed a lot of demand, both in the United States and elsewhere around the world. People have learned to use a lot less oil than they otherwise would have. And now economies are softening, particularly in Europe, Japan, and China. Economic growth is really slowing down. And when that happens, of course, oil demand declines. Meanwhile, we have increased supply coming from the U.S., from the shale patch, from light tight oil in the Bakken field in North Dakota and the Eagle Ford fields in South Texas. Also, some supply is coming back online from Libya and Iraq that has been offline for several years. And then Saudi Arabia, which is the swing producer and in past years has often moderated production, either increasing it or decreasing it in order to balance the market. Saudi Arabia has declined to reduce its oil production. And there's a lot of speculation as to why that is, but the Saudis have even unilaterally reduced their prices, especially to some of their Asian customers. So a combination of all of those factors has led to a precipitous decline in oil prices, over 50% at this point since the peak last summer.
So, Richard Heinberg, how does the low price of oil affect natural gas, if it does?
Well, it is affected. Of course, oil and gas are two different commodities, and their prices can be very different. Here in the U.S., we had very high oil prices for the last few years, but very low natural gas prices. Globally, however, natural gas prices are often tied to oil prices. For example, Gazprom, the big state-owned oil company in Russia, ties its the price of its natural gas exports to the price of oil. So during the last few years, the price of oil has been high, so therefore the price of natural gas in Europe and Asia has been high. And that has created the incentive for the idea of U.S. exporting natural gas. Now, in fact, the U.S. is still a net natural gas importer. We import almost 10% of our natural gas from Canada. Nevertheless, the U.S. has much lower natural gas prices than much of the rest of the world. So there was the idea that some companies in the U.S. could get rich by exporting natural gas through LNG to Europe and Asia. And that idea is not making much sense right now. With lower oil prices, that means lower natural gas prices in Europe and Asia. And there's really no marginal room for U.S. companies to make money on LNG exports at this point, because it's a very expensive business. Building the terminals, liquefying the natural gas, transporting it, that all requires a fairly high natural gas price, and currently the price is not high enough to justify it.
Does the low price of oil affect renewable energy projects?
Not direct impact. Of course, with low oil prices, of course, people tend to buy bigger cars again, and there's somewhat less, I'm sure, interest in hybrid and electric vehicles. So that has some effect on the renewable energy markets. But, you know, oil is used in the transport sector. It's not used in the electricity sector. And most of the renewables, solar and wind, geothermal and so on, all of those produce electricity. So we're really talking about two different markets. Natural gas prices have a much more direct impact on the renewables markets than oil does.
A lot of the work in the shale oil and gas fields is subcontracted out to pretty small companies. How will the low price of oil affect them?
They're operating on very small margins, and they have a lot of debt. So as oil prices are going down, they're having a big problem servicing that debt, and we're going to see a huge shakeout in that industry. A lot of those companies are going to consolidate or go under in the next few months.
That was Richard Heinberg, senior fellow at the Post Carbon Institute. For more information and analysis of oil price fluctuations, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As President Obama begins his last 2 years in office, one of his administration's legislative priorities is congressional approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The TPP, as it's known, is a proposed 12-nation trade agreement between the U.S., Australia, Brunei, Canada, Chile, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, and Vietnam. The agreement would set new rules on trade and non-trade issues such as food safety, internet freedom, the cost of pharmaceutical drugs, financial regulation, and environmental protection. With TPP negotiations nearing a conclusion, the administration is now pushing for a congressional vote on fast-track trade promotion authority, a mechanism created by Richard Nixon that would force Congress to vote on a trade agreement within 60 to 90 days of receiving it, with only limited time for debate and no amendments allowed. A broad coalition of progressive Democrats, labor unions, environmentalists, consumer advocates, and human rights activists have come together to oppose Fast Track, the TPP, and the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, another proposed multi-trillion-dollar free trade agreement being negotiated with a 28-nation European Union. Opponents maintain that these trade agreements, negotiated in almost complete secrecy, will weaken U.S. regulations on labor rights, environmental protections, food safety, and medicine prices, enhancing corporate power to the detriment of middle-class workers. Some conservative Republicans also oppose Fast Track, declaring it gives the executive branch too much power. Your reporter spoke with Elisa Simmons, Deputy Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who talks about the campaign to defeat the Trans-Pacific Partnership and Fast Track Authority amid the changed political climate in Washington after the GOP took control of the U.S. Senate earlier this month.
What we know about the TPP and what causes us to be in opposition is from leaked text. So I'll start there. You know, the biggest thing that we're in opposition to is the fact that this so-called free trade agreement, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, has been negotiated and has continued to be negotiated in complete secrecy. The public does not have access to the text. Media doesn't have access to the text. And members of Congress, whose constitutional responsibility it is to negotiate and improve these free trade, so-called free trade agreements, they have restricted access. And it's not even. Some members have more access than others. And so when we come right out of the box and talk about this, it's the fact that we don't know what's going on. We've seen several leaks from WikiLeaks and others. And I can tell you, the provisions that we've seen in those were opposed because they go far beyond just general, generic trade in terms of tariffs, exports, imports, quotas, all of that stuff. And they really get into issues that affect our everyday lives. Scott, I'm talking about food safety. I'm talking about internet freedom. I'm talking about access to affordable medicines. You know, when did these things, you know, have to do about trade? I'm even aspects specific to immigration. And so what we found from the leaked text are two really important things. One is that they're based on the same flawed NAFTA model. And we've seen what 20 years of NAFTA has done to this country in terms of jobs, in terms of immigration, et cetera. And two, there are all of these issues that impact our daily lives that go far beyond trade. Those are the things that are really scary.
Tell us what is changed now in Congress, given that the GOP now controls the Senate and they have added to their majority in the House. How does that enhance the possibility that this fast-track legislation will pass?
Yeah, you know, that's a really, really good question, and I've been answering that question for a lot of people since the midterm elections. Here's the thing, Scott. It really doesn't change the campaign, and it doesn't change the math that much, and I'll tell you why. The fight to stop Fast Track, and Fast Track is the key to stopping the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and we can talk about, you know, the Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement, TAFTA, that's the U.S.-EU deal, and there are other deals coming down the pike potentially. But the key to stopping all those deals is by stopping the president from getting fast-track authority. And the fight to stop fast-track has always been one that's focused on the House of Representatives. So the task is really to get our representatives to vote no. The Senate, we can't change the math there, and we've never really been able to be completely honest. And so the focus has always been the House. Now, talking about the fact that Republicans have gained, you know, a few seats in the House, we have to take a really close look at those seats and who they are, because there is a strong block of GOP House representatives, new and old, that do not want to give President Obama any more power. The Republican Party has been calling him the imperial president. There's a really good chance for us to win.
Elise, I wanted to ask you about public opinion here. It was a very hotly contested debate back in the 90s with the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA. We had Ross Perot on television debating Al Gore, I think it was back then.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some people might remember that. But I have the gut instinct that most people in this country, realizing that these free trade deals don't benefit the average worker in this country, are not in support of free trade deals. I might be wrong on that. What do public opinion polls tell us about the average American's view of this TPP and other free trade deals in the offing?
You're absolutely right. 20 years of NAFTA has really woken people up. And so, you know, I can tell you that the president's move to get fast track for the TPP is incredibly unpopular. 62% of U.S. voters oppose fast track for the TPP, and majorities of Democrats, Republicans, and independents alike reject the NAFTA-style status quo trade model. We've seen the polling. We know that's true. You know, on the Republican side, it's somewhere around 82%. So it's really high. This is, you know, not just another fight to stop a trade deal. This can really be the fight for our future and the last stand to the corporate globalization and takeover. I mean, this has huge implications, not only for our country, but for 11 other countries around the world.
That was Elise Simmons, Deputy Director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Learn more about the campaign to defeat the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.